For our session today, the introduction will be given by Liz Walsh. Liz is a member of the National Executive of Socialist Alternative, long-term organised socialist, and was last year, and this year as well, the campaign coordinator for Victorian Socialists. Liz will give a substantial introduction on the history of the New Deal, and then there'll be plenty of time for questions, discussion afterwards, so please make her welcome.
Great. Okay, so the New Deal period of the 1930s and the president at the time, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was a Democratic president, this period really looms large in the public imaginary, especially for American liberals and the American left. It's seen as a time when the Democrats and the president were on the side of working class people, that they fought to improve their economic and social living standards, and that this is sort of a heroic moment. And something that, you know, the left wants to return to. So we have Bernie Sanders in the US, one of the candidates to get the Democratic Party nominee, talking about the New Deal as a period when the president actually fought to guarantee economic rights. This was, you know, part of a sort of a program that he wants to build on. This is what he means by democratic socialism when he talks about socialism. Things like the Social Security Act, things like the various acts that guaranteed the right to organise. That's what his vision of what he's for is informed by. Same with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or AOC, who talks about the Green New Deal. She didn't make up the term, but nonetheless, it's sort of harking back to a period when the government intervened into the economy and built things, you know, built roads, built so. And so in order to tackle climate change, we can have, again, the state intervening to build renewable energy facilities, fast trains, and so on, to try and tackle climate change. So given it's very much used as a period when people say, let's look at that and we can do it again, it's important that we actually look at what is fact and what is fiction when it comes to the New Deal. What is the reality and what is the mythology around the New Deal that doesn't actually stand up to any looking into? So what were the character of the reforms? What was the relationship, actually, of the Democratic Party to the Labour movement? What was the coalition that Roosevelt built around himself? Was it really based on the working class and ethnic voters, or, you know, the centrality still of sections of capital? How were these reforms won? Was it the case that we're looking at this, you know, enlightened humanitarian president delivering? You know, what was it that actually... What kind of struggles were necessary in order to win these pretty mild reforms? And I think it's important to look at what approach the workers' movement took, which actually both strengthened it at the time, and what was the strategies that it took that weakened the labour movement and limited what it could achieve in this period. Okay, so the 1930s are a period of great economic turmoil, period of collapse in the American economy. So 1929, you had the stock market crash, you have the absolute collapse as well of industrial production by 40-50%. You have a situation where 30% of American workers are unemployed, and you have millions who are itinerant, who have been evicted from their homes, who are wandering around the country looking for jobs, looking for food. You have a situation where the Republican government, Hoover, is basically denying the severity of the problem, saying it's about individual responsibility if you're unemployed, you know, the 12-13 million people at the time. It's providing very little in the way of relief. And one of the symbols of the Great Depression is the Hoovervilles, named after the president. These sort of shanty towns that emerged around the cities and towns on the outskirts in sort of the wastelands, you know, made out of tin sheet metal and so on. So after the initial shock, there's growing discontent that's really starting to erupt. There's riots, looting by the unemployed, ongoing sort of demonstrations. There's strikes as well that start to emerge, particularly 32, 33, you start to see strikes, but most of them go down to defeat. The Communist Party and other radicals play a really important role in helping to try and cohere the unemployed, to assert themselves, to fight for relief, to fight for cash relief, not just to be paid in kind, and also to fight for jobs. And so they're agitating around the questions about wanting federal insurance for unemployed people, really trying to to popularise those slogans, really creating a sense of turmoil in society. Of course, the Communist Party at this time is it's not a mass party, but it's a sizable organisation. It really, in this period, builds up its sort of cadres who get experience in building militant struggles. But it's also a period when the Communist Party has its what's called ultra-left period, or the third period, where it's denouncing everyone to its right, some progressives, other radicals, as being essentially fascist. That they're just, because they're not for the Communist Party program, then they're going to be using their influence in the working class to essentially lead the way for reaction. So they kind of do isolate themselves in this period, but nonetheless also contribute. They could especially contribute in terms of starting to build up around anti-racism campaigning, the sharecroppers union in the South, and so on. Okay, so this is the context that Roosevelt gets elected. In November 1932, wave of discontent, wave of anger with Hoover's presidency, you have FDR coming in. So these are some of the images of the unemployed marches and demonstrations that the Communist Party and other radicals organised, and some of the radical newspapers as well that they distributed, fighting evictions, leading some strikes. So FDR. So FDR is not this very well-known figure. He was the New York governor from quite a wealthy family. During the campaign, he talked a lot about not government spending, actually the exact opposite. He talked about we need to cut spending, we need to save, we need to be frugal and so on. But nonetheless, he does start to kind of, feel the pressure of the struggles that are around him. So, and in the campaign, he coins the really, what was later called the happy phrase of that he pledges a new deal to the American people. And his Labour secretary, who writes a biography about him, about the real Roosevelt, says, well, actually, at the time, it was nothing more than just sort of a nice phrase without any formal content, that it made people feel good. So, he kept on using it. So it's not really the program that he gets elected on, but this sort of wave of outrage at the previous president. And what is his first action? Well, he's very keen to try and stabilise the American economy. So the first actions are actually about bailing out the big banks and at the expense of smaller banks and small depositors. So he puts a moratorium on bank withdrawals. So it's all about trying to save the financial system. This is one of his first main acts. Kind of reminiscent in some ways, of Obama and so on, bailing out the big end of town, and people, they got bailed out, we got sold out. But there is a sense that there needs to be some concessions in order to stabilise the political situation, have American capitalism be put back on a footing of growth. And so he actually wins a whole section of American capital to a program of saying, what we need to do is provide some relief, we need to give some rights to workers because we need much more orderly relationships between labour and management. All this sort of turmoil, all this wildcat strikes, all this disorder, we need to sort of bring under much more sort of control. So the sort of coalition that he has around him are some of the biggest sections of capital. So people like Standard Oil, the Rockefeller Foundation, General Electric, and these are often more capital-intensive industries that sort of not the labour-intensive industries that, are also sort of pushing towards a direction of we need a more sort of scientific management when it comes to labour relations. So they're actually some of the most important in terms of the money that they provide for his campaigns, the sort of power, the prestige, and so on. So one of the first acts also that Roosevelt does is around the works programs and around relief. This is one of the things that sort of is part of the mythology around Roosevelt as the sort of humanitarian. And I think that we have to see that the relief that he provides is seems generous really only in the context of what Hoover had been offering. So there's annually no more than $2 billion spent on relief. When you compare this to what they start to spend on arms spending, well before the US even enters the war in terms of the Second World War, that's annually starting at $75 billion, and it reaches $100 billion in 1945, the kind of money that they can marshal when it comes to the aiding of American imperialism as opposed to improving workers' living standards. So a bit more on the relief. So the jobs generally only covered around 25% of the unemployed. They were quite temporary. They often increase at times in the lead up to elections. So in the lead up to the 1936 election, there was a lot of works programs put on, and then immediately hundreds of thousands of workers were fired after the elections. And the wages were considered poverty wages. And one of the main slogans at the time was that it was not enough to live on, but it was just enough to stay alive. And the amount of money that people got on these jobs, the amount of jobs, the amount of relief, really was connected to the kinds of struggles that continue to happen around unemployed workers' rights. So you know, where there was more ongoing demonstrations and hunger marches and so on, that's when you see better conditions in the relief projects, and where there wasn't, it was pretty appalling. And by 1937, when the economy actually goes into a second recession, there's another crash, Roosevelt is cutting money to relief. He's actually moving away from government providing of relief when unemployment's actually going up, and focusing on arms spending instead, as he's sort of consciously building up a case for America intervening into the war. So the second, I think, one of the second main things that really builds up the mythology around Roosevelt is the questions of the right to organise, and in particular the National Industrial Recovery Act, or the NRA. So when the NRA was introduced and announced and so on, there was a lot of fanfare around it. There were parades for the National Recovery Act. There was posters put up all around the place, radio speeches and so on. You know, sort of great celebrating of the NRA. And I think it's important to look a bit more into what it constituted. One of the main things about the NRA was that it was about doing away with antitrust laws. So basically saying, industry, you can develop your own voluntary codes. If you agree to these codes, then all of the sort of things that are about limiting competition and trying to stop cartelization and monopolies, we'll do away with that. We'll allow for the concentration of industry, wiping out of inefficient capital if you agree to these codes that actually you yourself will write. And so trade associations, heads of industry wrote up these codes for fair competition, supposedly, you know, for minimum wages, for maximum hours and things like that. A lot of these codes enshrined really low wages. And one of the things that's really interesting is that is the clause that gets inserted into the NRA. Not at all the heart of the NRA. Part of it was around sort of industry really managing itself, was the 7A clause around the right to organise. So that gets inserted at the very last minute. It's under the pressure of AFL leaders, William Green and John Lewis, who sort of say, well, actually, if you want our support, you need to insert this clause. And William Green, who's the head of the American Federation of Labour, which is quite a conservative union federation, the clause he writes is quite a vague clause, which allows for company unions, essentially company-controlled employee representation, which rather than independent unions. And this is a really big problem that workers face all throughout this period, is trying to fight against companies trying to impose their controlled their unions as opposed to genuine independent unionism. And so Roosevelt argues, yes, company unions should have proportional representation on various labour boards and so on. So actually not at all committed to workers having the right to organise. So, yeah. So despite, I think, the limitations of the NRA, the idea that the president says that, yes, you have a right to organise, concedes this, had a big impact on the consciousness of workers, and also because a lot of union officials went out and campaigned and said the president wants you to organise, and it did build confidence. And you do see a flooding into the unions by workers, and in particular by workers in the mass industries. The American Federation of Labour was, as I said, a conservative federation. It was overwhelmingly concentrated on organising the craft workers, skilled workers. It had utter disdain for organising unskilled, semi-skilled workers. It wasn't interested in getting involved in the new mass industries that were emerging, organising the migrant labour, organising in particular black labour that had been moving up from the south throughout this period. He called them riffraff and rubbish and just strike prone. We're not interested in organising those people. But nonetheless, these people are the ones who are like surging into the unions and saying, clamouring to be able to have a right to join the union. And there's a little concession that they make, which is they form federal local unions, which are not actually genuine like democratic unions controlled by the members, but the officials say, okay, you can join, but we'll have the say over what happens. And they essentially kind of, the fact that they're agreeing to these shitty codes, low wages, company unions, things like that, a lot of workers actually rushed out of the unions as well quite quickly. Okay, so one of the things I think that's really critical about this period is the question about winning something on paper doesn't mean anything in reality if the employers are going to refuse to respect that. So they get the 7A clause, the right to organise, but then employers are like, fuck that, we're not going to allow unions to come in and collectively bargain, we're going to remain anti-union. And so you see enormous employer resistance, the sacking people who try and join unions, sacking people who are taking strike action, sacking people who are speaking up. And so there are millions of people that have to fight all throughout this period for the right to join the union, for the implementation of what had existed in terms of law. And they come up against huge obstacles. So there's the courts that they have to fight. The courts implement, you know, all the friendly judges have injunction after injunction to try and criminalise the picket lines. You have the intervention of Roosevelt and the government and the various mediators that he sends around trying to say, you know, stop your strikes, stop your battles well before you've even won a contract, before you've had any union recognition. You know, we should go back to just what they sort of term the swamp of government mediation, just derail that into endless stalling where workers wouldn't achieve their main goals. And even actually after the second New Deal period of sort of 35, 36, when the National Labor Relations Act is passed, or the Wagner Act, you still have a problem of employers refusing to recognise the unions, and 50% of the sit-down strikes in this period, the huge wave of factory occupations that happen around just the simple demand of the right to have their union recognised. So not only are they facing courts and, you know, and government machinery, they're also facing, obviously, the violence of the state. So you have the police who are sent in against the strikers. They, in basically nearly every strike, seem to immediately swear in hundreds of deputies, so just anti-union citizens who they'd become police overnight. And here we have a picture of the mayor in Pennsylvania during a steel strike, swearing in deputies, giving them clubs to go and attack workers on strike. There's the Pinkerton agency and the various kind of private agencies who are just, you know, thousands and thousands. Like Ford actually had an army of thousands, the biggest private army in the world, to try and prevent workers from being able to organise, had to come up against them, who'd have, you know, tear gas and gun down workers. And, of course, then there's the state and National Guard that workers faced. And during the period of Roosevelt's, two terms, the first two terms, the National Guard is sent in over 70% of the time, its activity is 70% of the time directed at smashing up strikes. And often the people who are sending in the National Guard are Democratic New Deal governors who are hostile to workers fighting for their rights. One of the strikes that's particularly bloody in this period is the textile workers' strike in 1934. This is an incredible battle. There are 400,000 workers who participate in trying to unionise the textile mills and to fight against the poverty wages. And, yeah, they come out against, I think it's over 12 governors, mostly Democrats, send in the National Guard to repress workers. And here you also have Roosevelt leaning on the union leaders to pressure them to call off the strike before they've won their demand. And so, you know, in the end, the thing that they offer is that the government's going to have a study into the conditions of the textile industry. And the defeat of the textile strike is really, really important. So that you have in the South squads of both women and men flying pickets, going from mill town to mill town, shutting down the mills, calling out more workers. That's how you get the 400,000. It's this incredible wave. It's this possibility in the South in particular to really, for the labour movement to throw down roots. And instead, you have this terrible defeat, and for decades, labour organising in the South is set backwards. So it's a terrible defeat. But it does give you a sense, like the incredible militancy of these workers, of the kind of possibilities that are starting to emerge in terms of the American labour movement. And 1934 is known as the turning point, not because of the defeat of his strike, but because of three successful victories. So this is some of the... This is a newspaper at the time in the South. On the repression. So one of the victories... So there's three key strikes, and they're all led not by the sort of traditional union officials, but by radicals of various shades. So Trotskyists in Minneapolis who lead the Teamsters strike. You have the Communist Party militants leading a general strike in San Francisco of dock workers that then involves, you know, draws in maritime workers, trucking and so on, and, you know, huge strike there. And also in Toledo. And I wanted to sort of have a little look at Toledo because the auto workers there, their strike, I think, really helps to lay the basis for the huge organising that happens in auto. So in Toledo, which is an industrial town, where there's sort of auto part plants, glass plants and so on, in this town, during the Depression, the Depression really hits hard. So there is 30% unemployment in this town. And workers there are trying to strike over wage cuts and also speed ups on the plant, and for the right to have their union recognised. So initially, the AFL Federal Local calls off their strike in February, you know, and says that, no, we want negotiation. You don't have a right to strike. We'll tell you what to do. But by April, they're getting frustrated and they're like, we can't wait any longer, this is just stalling, so they go on strike. But immediately you have a situation where the courts issue an injunction, the union officials from the Federal Local respect the injunction, and so for 3 weeks you have scabs going in, breaking the strike. There's like 1,800 strike breakers that have been amassed. And so the strike is going to go down to defeat. And this is when a group of workers actually go and approach the Unemployed Workers League, which had been organised for many years in the town, in particular by a radical known in the organisation of the American Workers' Party. And initially, I think it was called the Centre for Progressive Labour Action. And they're headed by a guy called A.J. Must, or Musty. He's a sort of radical pacifist, former priest who's really committed to labour organising, and in particular to the principle of saying that the unemployed, 30% of the town's unemployed, that they need to have unity with those in jobs, that they can't be used as strike breakers. They've got to be, their interests are in trying to defend workers' conditions. And so the Unemployed Workers League recommends that what we need to do is actually defy the injunction. And they write a letter to the court saying, we're going to be defying the injunction. We're going to bring thousands of unemployed workers down to the picket lines and actually going to start shutting down the workplace. Those leaders get jailed or they get sent to court. They get told, if you go back to the picket line, you're going to go to jail. They immediately go back to the picket line with their thousands of unemployed workers. And within a couple of days, you see 6,000, then 10,000 unemployed workers and workers picketing the plant. The police come in to try and break up the picket to get the scabs both out of the workplace, and then the shift change to come in, and then there's a almighty fight that develops. The workers have amassed bricks to try and fend off the police and to stop the scabs. The company has deputies on the roof of the factory with tear gas that are throwing tear gas bombs at the pickets. And there's basically the brawl ends in the police withdrawing, and the determination of the workers mean that they can lay siege to the factory. And for 19 hours, the scabs are inside until the National Guard arrives, and there's about 900 National Guard that arrive. But instead of withdrawing, they battle the National Guard for 6 days in Toledo. You know, so there's fights down alleyways, fights on rooftops, fights behind billboards, just trying to like a guerrilla skirmish. And you can see some of the images of the National Guard occupying Toledo. And Eventually, the company capitulates, agrees to close the factory, and then ultimately to come to an agreement after there's a proposal for a general strike. There's a general strike that gets voted up from all the, like basically all the local unions. There's 40,000 workers who demonstrate in the town after a number of workers are shot dead. And so this gives you a bit of a feel for the kind of, I think, politics that could lead the struggle forward. So, you know, when the government mediators come in, don't participate in their various attempts to corral and derail the movement into, you know, the swamp of mediation. You need to actually rely on direct action of workers, confrontation with the bosses, the self-activity of workers in and the unemployed, and try and draw in as broad a layer of workers as possible rather than sort of limit those who are participating. You need to prepare yourself for confrontation, for resisting the violence of the state. You know, that, you know, when the National Guard comes in, how are you going to actually organise yourself to fight them off? So, you know, really a feel for the kind of, you know, rank-and-file militancy, democratic organising, confrontation rather than collaboration, all of this was central features of the three strikes that happened that end up becoming a key turning point for the labour movement. So, it really showed that it was possible to fight and to win. And so you see, like, this really opens the door for American labour organising in 35, 36 and 37. And it also lays the basis, obviously, for the incredible industrial union that was the United Auto Workers Union, but also for the growth of industrial unionism in the US and the emergence of what becomes the Congress for Industrial Organising, but the initially the committee. So there's all this pressure starting to build up in the AFL. So, as I said, the old leadership are hostile to organising the riffraff. But there's a section of the union bureaucrats who see the writing on the wall and think, you know, if we don't start to move to organising industrial workers, well then these militants, the Trotskyists, the communists, the socialists, the AJ Musk radical pacifists, they're going to be the ones who form the leadership of industrial organising. So we need to start throwing ourselves in there to be able to control the process. And that's what John Lewis, who is no radical, ends up doing. He was the head of the United Mine Workers Union, not a radical in the sense that in the Great Depression he toured the coal mines to actually say don't go on strike when there's massive wage cuts happening. So he moves to form a committee within the AFL to try and organise industrial unions. So it's in this context, I think, that we look at the Second New Deal, this doubling of strikes, the militancy, the involvement of millions of workers fighting for their right to organise, that you can understand what happens in 1935 and 36 in terms of Roosevelt delivering the Second New Deal. So the Social Security Act, which provides for some very minimal unemployment insurance and old age pensions, and also the second act around the right to organise. Interestingly, the Social Security Act is part of getting it through, because of course the Democrat Party is a party that requires, part of its wing is in the South, and the Dixiecrats, to support the Social Security legislation, they said, well, we're not going to support it if agriculture and domestic servants are included in having access to unemployment and old age insurance. So they passed the law exempting agriculture, so exempting black labour, exempting whole sections of women workers from those benefits, really until the 1960s. Okay, so one of the things about this period is that the incredible struggles that are starting to radicalise to workers, developing experiences of what Democrats in power look like, the violence they're prepared to enact, creates possibilities for a political break from the Democrats, for the establishment of a Labor Party, an independent working class party, to start to sort of give a political voice to workers that's not just trapped within the framework of pro-capitalist politics of either Democrats or tying yourself to the Republicans. And there's actually dozens of local Labor Party experiments, farmer Labor Parties at state and local levels that get established in this period. And in fact, in 1934, after the defeat of the United Textile Workers Union, that official was quite, you know, conservative. He agreed to Roosevelt's argument, yes, call off the strike. He starts to say, actually, I was naive. What we actually do need is our own party. And, you know, he starts sort of agitating in various conventions and trying to put up Labour Party motions and so on. And probably the high point is around the United Auto Workers, who in 1935 at their founding conference, they, you know, not only have like incredible program of saying, you know, we want no dependence on AFL leaders, we want rank and file democracy, direct action and so on. They also pass motions saying at their conference that they want political independence, and they also don't want to support Roosevelt's second run, that they're not going to back his campaign. So you can see, like, amongst the militants, amongst the, some of the most, you know, vanguard leading elements of the class, there's a real possibility for establishing a Labour Party. And instead, that opportunity gets crushed. And there's a key role is played by the CIO officials, like John Lewis, who very much see that the advance of the union is connected to currying favour with Democrats. We want to have an alliance with the Democrats, and by showing that, you know, we can get Labour votes out, we can get raise money for the Democrats, you'll then in turn give us, you know, some concessions. And that's sort of, that's what political action is. But also the Communist Party at this time also play a key role in stopping moves to forming an independent political party for workers. And, they basically say, well, they're not ready to back Roosevelt, but they oppose an independent candidate and they spend their time sort of campaigning against the Republicans. And this is starting the kind of move of the Communist Party away from supporting independent militant action on the shop floor towards an alliance with the Democrats, middle-class allies. So this is the period of the Popular Front turn. So I talked about earlier in the early period of the Great Depression, their ultra-left, wildly sectarian, isolate themselves from other political forces. But you see in 1935 a dramatic flip. And this is because the nature of the Communist Party is that it's not this democratic organisation. It's thoroughly Stalinised, has been for many, many years, where basically the Russians picked the leadership. And slogans, tactics, policy on trade union approach, all is developed pretty much within Russia. And so in 1935, you have a shift in the Stalinist bureaucracy in Russia, and they decide that our priority is now to form alliances with France, with England, with America, with Western democracies against the growing threat of Germany and German militarism on Russia. And so we want our communist parties to be essentially our, you know, our voice out there trying to build support for an alliance between Russia and the US. We can't be seen as constant disruptors and, you know, fermenting discontent and so on. So basically there is a sort of a steady slide from 35, 36, 37 of the Communist Party, instead of being trying to lead militant struggles, trying to put a lid and using their authority and prestige that they have to put a lid on militant action. Okay, so the thing is, I guess, that it's contradictory, and there are still thousands and thousands of Communist Party militants who don't just immediately flip and continue to try and play a militant role in their workplace. And really, one of the high points of this is the 1936-37 Flint sit-down strike. And sit-down strike, again, was for simple union recognition. In General Motors, in Flint, Michigan, General Motors, one of the major corporations building cars. This sit-down strike lasted 44 days, and it, you know, the sit-down strike of, you know, seizing the factories was incredibly powerful, because obviously it was part of saying, you know, we don't respect your private property, but also involved, you know, the need for creative organising, to have entertainment, bedding, various committees to organise the defence, the you know, building public support and, you know, massive amounts of self-activity, working class democratic organising. And, in the Flint sit-down strike, the police and thugs come in to try and evict them. They fight back, not just the, obviously a little less so the men inside the factories, but all the people amassed outside on the pickets, including women who organised the emergency brigade, the women's emergency brigades that had red berets and like red armbands and organised other sort of defence of the factory in terms of providing of food, but in particular the physical defence as well, trying to stop the police from evicting workers. And so this is a bit the occupation. Some of the women. The union officials actually make an argument to say, look, GM's not folding, we need to leave the plant. And the Communist Party fraction inside the plant agrees that they should leave. And there's a key role played by the Socialist Party militants, Kermit Johnson in particular, who argues, we've got this great strategy. I actually think we should go out. We don't have much union density in this plant, but it's strategic, this plant. This plant is key to General Motors production. We need to go and seize that. And they're like, no, that's suicide because you don't have any support in there. And so, but eventually the SP convinces in the strike meetings that this is what we should do, and they organise a ruse. So they put out publicly that they're going to go and seize a not very strategic plant, and so all of the police and thugs go out to that plant to defend it, and so they just leave a few dozen to go and seize the plant number one. And it's this that then forces GM to crumble, to sign the first contract, a six-month contract, recognising the UAW as the sole bargaining agent for workers, and really begins the sort of huge wave of sit-down strikes. It has a tremendous impact on the consciousness and confidence of workers across the country. And you have 500,000 workers participate in sit-down strikes in the next year, trying to fight for union recognition. So this included, obviously, auto in particular, steel, but also retail workers, restaurant workers, people who are in the box where you screen the theater, the movie theater, the projection box. Yeah, they have sit-ins. So you can see there's sort of a flip going on amongst the union officials and the leadership of the Communist Party. They're starting to try and clamp down on the militancy, but it's not easy. And indeed, even when they start to even move more decisively against trying to put a lid on the union militancy, people they can't just tame people that that easily. So 1937 should have been a year when the workers' movement consolidates itself. It should have been a period where there'd been the forming of a mass workers' party built off the back of the rise of these industrial unions and the whole layer of militants that exists. So instead, 1937 is a period of retreat. And as I said earlier, there's the economic crisis that hits again. So it does put workers on the defensive. There would have been defensive struggles, but that wouldn't have been enough to clamp things down. You have Roosevelt moving much more decisively against the labour movement. So, often speaking to union officials, telling them that you should stop the strike and so on, putting immense pressure on them. But here you actually see Roosevelt speak more openly in, basically blaming workers for the violence that happens on the various picket lines, in particular in the attempt to organise steel. So after the UAW sit-down strike, and seeing what happened to General Motors, the biggest steel corporation, US Steel, quickly signs a contract to allow for union collective bargaining. But there's a section of steel capital who are quite powerful, called Little Steel, who are not part of US Steel, who decide that they're going to resist the attempts to unionise the industry. And it's sort of the beginnings, really, of even more reaction by sections of capital against the various reforms. And so in the Little Steel strike, it's the union officials basically, as part of the sort of move away from some of the militancy, just have sort of legal picketing. There's, the courts say you can only have 10 people in the picket line, so it's ineffective. we'll respect that. You know, so the whole approach of attempting to organise Little Steel is, you know, not using the methods that were so central to winning the rights on the ground. And it's very much repressed bloodily, and in particular at the Memorial Day Massacre, which is in Chicago, the Republic plant. You have the sort of amassing of police workers are just sort of unarmed, marching towards the picket after having a picnic. They're marching towards the gate of Republic plant, and they have an argument erupts between the police and the marchers. The sort of marchers are marched across the field, and all of a sudden, tear gas goes off, clubs start swinging, and they start firing into the backs of the unarmed workers, killing 10 people. And this is when Roosevelt says, you know, John Lewis and all the CIA officials had expected that, having gotten the vote out for Roosevelt in the 1936 election, having helped him achieve a massive landslide, that he would come to their aid. And instead, he says, a plague on both their houses. So very much, you know, 10 workers shot in the back. I have no sympathy or solidarity with you. And this defeat really starts to break the momentum of the CIO's rise. And you see a situation where Roosevelt starts to swing against providing any more reforms. So there's cuts to the relief, but there's no more progressive reforms that get passed through through Congress. Instead, there's this huge build-up that starts happening towards war and a massive increase in arms spending from 37 on. And really, he's trying to start to, you know, to eschew his, like, Labour allies. And so the main thing is really trying to rebuild support amongst the capitalist class around the drive towards asserting US hegemony in the world. And, yeah, so this is a terrible period, because as he's sort of trumpeting American militarism, the CIO and the Communist Party are saying, yes, we back you, Roosevelt, 100%. In fact, the Communist Party in the UAW agrees that we've got to shut down the militancy. We will stop, like, rank-and-file caucuses. They'll become legal. We'll ban local union newspapers that are about trying to talk about what militants want to communicate to other workers in the factory. And, in fact, they even voted to allow, to say to General Motors, we give you permission to fire anyone who engages in unauthorised wildcat strike action. So this is a period where some people talk about how, you know, the Communist Party has its greatest influence. This is a period when the Communist Party has a lot of union officials, union organisers. You know, it has the ear of some of the top CIO officials, like John Lewis, who's employed some of the Communist Party people. It's a period when their membership grows to 80,000, and then ultimately through the war to 100,000. But you've got to say the influence that they have was not used to advance worker struggles, but to play a key role in holding things back. And ultimately, I think that they play a key role in helping to shift politics to the right in American society. You know, what should have emerged out of this period of immense turmoil in the American working class is a stronger socialist movement, even if in periods of the war and crisis that there'd have to be you know, defensive actions rather than the offensive actions that you see in this period, but that there could have been something really significant built for the future. Instead, what we have is the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947. Instead, we have McCarthyism. We have a situation where the Communist Party has alienated itself, really, from whole sections of rank-and-file militants who see their role of trying to crush militancy, of being for strike-breaking, for no-strike pledges throughout the war period as part of supporting Russia in the war effort. You have a situation where instead of a political break from the Democrats, you have the labour movement, social movements, the black movement being, for the next decades, tied to this capitalist political party. And I think getting that sense of it didn't have to be like this, that it seemed like it came out of nowhere. There's a really great book on the rise of the CIO by Art Priest, who was a militant himself and involved in Toledo, involved in unemployed workers' struggles. And he's like, an anniversary, a 20th anniversary of his book, and there's all these militants that are coming together, the Toledo strikers, San Francisco dock workers, and so everyone's coming together. And he's like, we didn't think that we were on the verge of a huge explosion in labour struggles. Your time will come. This explosion seemed to come out of nowhere, but it showed the real potential of American labour. But politics matters, and just having heroicism, militancy is not enough. You actually need politics that is about saying we want to utilise the strength of workers at our base. We want to act independently of union officials who are trying to hold things back, and in particular, of the Democratic Party machine. That kind of politics is, I think, necessary today as well. As we try and rebuild a left after decades of being pushed back, that kind of politics, I think, needs to be fueling the political vision and the political strategies that the left employs today. That's how the gains were won, and the opposite is how everything got pushed back.